Good morning, everyone. So again, this morning we'll start with a short meditation just to relax the body, relax the mind, and get ready for our discussion. So find a nice, comfortable posture. As always, we begin by preparing the body. So keeping the back nice and straight. And allow the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. All the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly, not controlling the breath in any way. And preparing the mind, setting it in a state of ease and relaxation. Not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now narrow your focus and focus on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen, noticing the sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. And maintain that ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. And if you find yourself becoming distracted, remember the first thing to do is simply relax and then release the distraction and very gently return to focusing on the breath. So relax, release, and return each time you notice you've become distracted. Simply keep coming back to the breath again and again. Now, if you find yourself constantly becoming distracted, then as a way to help stabilize your attention, we can introduce counting the breath. So at the end of the in-breath, mentally note one, and then focus on the sensations of the breath through the following out-breath and following in-breath. And at the end of the next in-breath, mentally note two. And this way we can count from one up to 10 and then go back to one again. And if you lose the count at any point, simply go back to one. So now we can experiment with counting the breath and see if that helps to stabilize our attention. So let's start with a short review of some of the main points from yesterday before we move on to today's topic. So yesterday morning we began by looking at the point that we often feel that the source of our happiness and the source of our suffering is out there in the world. And so one of the main methods we use to try to find happiness and overcome suffering is we manipulate the things around us. We try to attract people, places and things that seem to be the source of our happiness. And we try to push away or avoid people, places and things that seem to be the source of our suffering. But as we saw yesterday morning, this is not really a very effective strategy for a number of reasons. And all that that does is that attachment and aversion to the pleasant and unpleasant things, all that does is it just induces a lot of unnecessary suffering. It doesn't really help us to overcome suffering, and it doesn't really help us to get any closer to any sort of genuine happiness. So there we saw that we need to distinguish between pleasure and happiness. Generally or often we identify pleasure as happiness. And of course there's nothing wrong with pleasure, but we need to understand that pleasure is simply a temporary transient experience. It'll come, it'll go, it's a stimulus-based experience, and it's never going to fulfill us and satisfy us. And we need to identify a second form of happiness called genuine happiness. Genuine happiness, of course, is a state of inner well-being that does not require any particular stimulus to be present. And so, of course, this is what we are focusing on here in the Buddhist spiritual path, is how we can achieve this state of genuine happiness. And we're going to be looking at that, of course, in a lot of detail in the coming days. But very simply, of course, to achieve that state of genuine happiness, we really need to eliminate the mental afflictions in our mind. Because as long as we've got anger, jealousy, craving, anxiety, depression, and so on, as long as these things are in our mind, we're never going to find any genuine happiness. If we can eliminate these mental afflictions, we can find that state of genuine happiness. And so we saw also yesterday morning that we looked a little bit of the history of Buddhism, how it began on this planet. And we saw that Shakyamuni Buddha became enlightened 2,500 years ago, and that he spent 45 years wandering around India, teaching what he had discovered. And then after the time of the Buddha, Buddhism started to spread throughout India more and then further afield. And it spread through two languages, Pali and Sanskrit. And through the Pali language, it spread into Sri Lanka and then up through Southeast Asia. So all of those Buddhist traditions now, of course, refer back to the original Pali texts. But also Buddhism spread in India through the Sanskrit language. And through Sanskrit, it spread up over the Himalayas onto the Silk Route, into China, Korea, Japan, and down to Vietnam, and then also into Tibet. So, of course, those traditions now, Buddhist traditions now, which are often called the Mahayana traditions, they refer back to the original Sanskrit texts. And we saw yesterday there that when Buddhism spread into Tibet, there are four schools of Tibetan Buddhism being formed: Nyingma, Kagyu, Sakya, and Gelug. And the foundation, of course, of all Buddhist traditions is the Four Noble Truths. And we're using the Four Noble Truths as the framework of all of our discussions in this course. And the Four Noble Truths, we looked at a very brief introduction yesterday morning of the Four Noble Truths. We used that analogy of a physical illness. So we saw there that we can see that the Buddha is like our doctor. He is diagnosing what our current condition is, what condition we find ourselves in. And he used the word dukkha to describe our human condition. And part of that condition, human condition of dukkha, is that sometimes, of course, we have unpleasant suffering experiences. Sometimes we have pleasant experiences. But underlying both our pleasant and unpleasant experiences is the fact that there's always a potential for suffering to arise in our life. And in that sense, dukkha is sometimes translated as unsatisfactory, that the human condition is unsatisfactory. Why? Because unpleasant experiences we don't want, they're definitely unsatisfactory. Even our pleasant experiences are unsatisfactory in the sense that they don't last and they're not reliable. But at the deepest level, our human condition is unsatisfactory because there's this always this potential for suffering to arise in our life. And so this is a little bit the meaning of the word dukkha, the condition we find ourselves in. Why are we stuck in this state? The second noble truth, the truth of the cause or origin of dukkha or suffering. And there we briefly saw yesterday that the cause or why we're in this state of dukkha is these mental afflictions: anger, jealousy, craving, fear, anxiety, and so on. And that we briefly saw that from a Buddhist perspective, these mental afflictions are coming from our distorted view of reality. Sometimes this is called ignorance. We're ignorant. We have a misunderstanding of the nature of reality. We don't understand how we exist and how the world around us exists. And that leads to these mental afflictions, which lead to our suffering, this state of dukkha. But of course, the Buddha's prognosis was that we can cure ourselves of this state of dukkha or suffering, because these mental afflictions are not part of the nature of our mind, that we can eliminate them from our mind by coming to realize the nature of reality. And if we do, we can overcome all mental afflictions and suffering. We can transcend the state of dukkha. And the state of dukkha, of course, we're in this state life after life. And this cycling in this state of dukkha, life after life, of course, in Sanskrit is called samsara, often translated into English as cyclic existence. We can transcend samsara. We can achieve a healthy state, a state of liberation from suffering and its causes, the state called nirvana. So that's the third noble truth, the truth of cessation, the truth of the ending of all suffering and its causes. But then, of course, what is the medicine? What do we need to do to achieve this healthy state? Fourth noble truth, truth of the path, path leading to the cessation of suffering. What practices do we need to engage in? And so we're going to, of course, be looking at those as well. And so that was our brief overview into the Four Noble Truths. And then yesterday afternoon, we looked at the Buddhist theory of mind. Because what we can see here is that central to everything is the mind, because it's the mind or the mental afflictions in the mind that are the source of suffering. And it's by eliminating the mental afflictions in our mind that we can find genuine happiness. So the mind is key. So we looked a little bit at a brief introduction into the Buddhist theory of mind. And yesterday afternoon, I also briefly introduced another theory of mind, the scientific materialistic theory of mind, that everything basically in the known universe can be explained in terms of matter and energy. And in that theory of mind, of course, the mind is basically the brain, the function of the brain, or sometimes called an emergent property of the brain. So, of course, in that theory of mind, thoughts and emotions can be explained entirely in terms of electrical signals and chemical flow in the brain, that thoughts and emotions are nothing more than this. And what we saw there was that one of the implications of that theory of mind is that mind, according to that theory, popped into existence at the beginning of our life, and our mind and consciousness will vanish at the end of our life. It will simply disappear because the brain will stop functioning. Then we saw in the Buddhist theory of mind that the simple definition of the Buddhist theory of mind is that the mind is clear and knowing, or has clarity and awareness. And we saw there that this word clarity implies that from a Buddhist perspective, the mind is not physical. So in Buddhism, there are not just physical phenomena. There's not just matter and energy in this universe. There's mental phenomena. There's mind. So the mind is not the brain. Although, of course, the mind and brain have a very close relationship and they affect each other, of course. And then we looked at some presentations of mind, different perspectives of mind in terms of these six consciousnesses, the fact that we can experience six types of objects. Then we look briefly at the functioning of the mind, this idea of the main mind and mental factors. And then briefly at the end, we looked at the fact that we can talk about levels of mind from coarse to subtle to very subtle. So that was a little bit the Buddhist theory of mind. What I'd like to begin by now is to finish that a little bit by talking about what are the implications of the Buddhist theory of mind. And so to look at the implications of the Buddhist theory of mind, again, I'd like to read from Alan Wallace from his Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up, and then we'll make a few more comments. And he says the following: neither in Western science or in Western religious scripture do we have so compelling a theory of the origins and nature of consciousness. If Buddhism has anything to offer Western civilization, it may well be its profound understanding of the mind. Buddhism presents many theories about the functioning and potential of human consciousness that can be tested empirically. If these theories are finally refuted by scientific means, then the core of the Buddhist worldview will be undermined. On the other hand, if many of these hypotheses are confirmed by sound and thorough empirical investigation, we may need to radically alter our interpretation of both scientific and religious knowledge. Let us now see how a Buddhist theory of consciousness explains death. We can begin with an analogy. The central principle of modern physics is the conservation of mass energy. This means that matter and energy may undergo innumerable transformations, from solid to liquid to gas, from thermal to electromagnetic energy, and so on. But no quantity of mass energy is ever lost, nor does any form of matter or energy ever arise from nothing. So one of the fundamental principles of classical physics is this conservation of mass energy. You can't create mass energy, you can't destroy it, you can simply transform it. Of course, one of the implications of that in classical physics is when they talk about the origins of the universe, then one of the most common theories we hear about today is the Big Bang theory. But of course, they would not say that the Big Bang theory means that the universe came into existence from nothing, because that would violate one of the fundamental principles of classical physics. So they often talk about this infinitely dense singularity that exploded into the universe. And one of other popular theories in classical physics about origins of universe is cyclic Big Bang, that there's these cycles of Big Bang implosion, Big Bang implosion. And that theory actually is a little bit similar to the Buddhist theory of cosmology, the Buddhist cosmology of history of the universe. It's sort of basically a cyclic Big Bang theory. So he goes on to say, in Buddhist thought, we encounter a similar theory of the conservation of consciousness. It says an individual's continuum of consciousness undergoes innumerable changes, from the waking state to dreaming to deep sleep, from emotional turbulence to serenity, and so on. But consciousness never vanishes, nor does consciousness ever arise from nothing. So in Buddhism, there's a similar theory of conservation of consciousness. You can't create consciousness, you can't destroy it. You can simply transform it. Which means, of course, one of the implications of this, like the Big Bang theory, is that consciousness didn't come into existence from nothing at the beginning of this life. That there was a previous moment of consciousness at the beginning of this life. Just like there was a previous moment of matter and energy before the beginning of this universe. So that implies, of course, previous life. And similarly, at the end of this life, you can't destroy consciousness, meaning it won't vanish. It will transform. It will have a next moment, which implies a future life. So one of the implications of the Buddhist theory of mind is past and future lives. So going on, he says, the Buddhist view is that mass energy does not transform into consciousness, nor does consciousness disappear into mass energy. Mass energy is conserved as mass energy, and mental events, including consciousness, are conserved as mental events. Thus, this theory refutes the belief that consciousness originally evolved from mass energy as an emergent property. It also denies that the consciousness of a fetus arises purely from the physical conditions that produced its body. With regard to consciousness, the Buddhist theory is compatible with much scientific evidence about cosmology, embryology, and death. However, it stands in opposition to the materialistic interpretation of that evidence. Here comes a very important point here. Buddhism asserts that all natural phenomena, including, of course, mental events, arise in dependence upon two types of causes, substantial causes and cooperative conditions. So this is a very important point.
Causes for the consciousness?
For everything.
For everything.
Everything that exists. So every phenomena in the known universe, physical or mental, it comes into existence depending on two types of causes, substantial cause and cooperative conditions. A very simple example is a plant. The substantial cause of a plant is the seed. So the substantial cause is the thing which transforms into the result. But of course, for a seed to transform into a plant, we need also cooperative conditions. We need soil, sunlight, water, and so on. Without these cooperative conditions, a seed will never transform into a plant. So for the plant to exist, it exists depending on substantial cause and cooperative conditions. So every physical phenomena is produced through substantial cause and cooperative conditions. Every mental event, is produced through substantial cause, cooperative conditions. So Alan Wallace has a few things to say about this. He says, the substantial cause of a sprout of wheat, for example, is the grain of wheat from which it grows. That grain transforms into the sprout, and its molecular structure determines that it will be a sprout of wheat and not, say, corn. Many other conditions, including weather patterns, temperature, and farming methods, may contribute to the growth of the sprout, but they do not act as the dominant substantial cause of the grain. Physical events arise from physical substantial causes. but their cooperative conditions may include both physical and mental events. A wheat crop may have been sown, for instance, because of a farmer's intention, and it may be irrigated because of his wish to have a profitable harvest. Intention and desire are clearly mental events, and they can be instrumental in the growth of a field of wheat. Mental events arise from mental substantial causes, but their cooperative conditions may include both mental and physical events. Amino acids, DNA, neurological processes, diet, and environmental conditions, all these physical events contribute to the emergence of states of consciousness, but they do not play the dominant substantial role of preceding mental functions and impressions. According to Buddhism, consciousness is, and this is something I briefly mentioned yesterday, this is also very important. According to Buddhism, consciousness is regarded as an event or continuum of events rather than as a thing moving through time. Energy also can be best understood as an event and even matter, which appears to us so thingish, dissolves into a matrix of events when it is closely examined. So Buddhism is not arguing that the mental realm is just as real and tangible as the physical world appears to be. Rather, it asserts that the substantial appearance of the world of physical things is deceptive, and that both physical and mental phenomena are best understood as interdependent events. This implies that no phenomenon exists with its own intrinsic independent identity, because each phenomenon depends on others. In Buddhism, this is a key concept. So remember again, as I mentioned yesterday, and this is very important and very helpful to help us appreciate the Buddhist view of reality that we're going to talk about in detail later. When we look at the physical world, there appears to be things there moving through time. This bowl seems to be the same bowl that was here yesterday, and it'll seem to be the same bowl here tomorrow. So superficially, this seems to be moving through time, this thing. But if we look very closely, what we can see is there are no things moving through time. There is simply a flow of change that our eye can't pick up. If we go down to the atomic level, of course, there's just constant flux and change. And science, of course, has proven this. At the atomic level, there's just constant flux and change all the time. But our eyes can't see that. So we are deceived by appearances. It seems that they're solid and unchanging. And that's how we relate to them. But again, if we look closely, there's just a flow of change happening at the physical world level. And to make sense of that flow of change, we create objects out of that flow. And we have to do that to make some sense out of the flow. No problem. Similarly, at the mental level, the mind seems to be a thing that moves through time. But if we look closely, the mind is also just a flow of change. So again, the mind is a continuum of mind. It's a flow of change. And that flow of change of experience, we call that the mind because it's useful. And what we saw was that in Buddhist theory of mind, like in classical physics, the theory of conservation of mass energy, Buddhism has the same theory or similar theory of conservation of consciousness. Meaning you can't create consciousness, you can't destroy it. You can simply transform it. And of course, the mind that we have now is created through substantial cause and cooperative conditions. So what is the substantial cause of the mind we have now? Is the mind of a moment ago. That mind of a moment ago plus all the conditions transform that mind into the mind we have now. Which means that at the end of this line, then because of conservation of consciousness principle, when our this life finishes, consciousness doesn't disappear. It doesn't become non-existent. Another moment of consciousness is produced. Similarly, at the beginning of this life, consciousness didn't pop into existence from nothing. There was a previous moment of consciousness that acted as the substantial cause for the first moment of the mind in this life. So this theory of Buddhist theory of mind, together with the principle of conservation of consciousness, implies past and future lives. So this is one of the implications of the Buddhist theory of mind. So that's all I wanted to talk about mind. Is there any last questions about that? And then we'll move on to the topic this morning.
How can we understand the beginning of life in this perspective? Is it...
What do you mean by life?
Where was the consciousness before life appears on the planet?
We're going to talk about Buddhist cosmology tomorrow, but the very simple answer is, according to Buddhism, there are life on many places, many planets. There are multiple world systems, multiple universes with multiple life forms. Mental. Yeah. So remember, in Buddhism, mind is not material. It's not atoms. It's not energy. It's mental phenomena. So what we can talk about, like we can talk about these particles, we can talk about moments of consciousness, an individual moment of consciousness. In the present moment, this moment of consciousness in the next moment produces another mind and so forth. So we can talk about moments of consciousness. So the mind has no spatial properties, no physical properties. Yes. There's what?
Is there an evolution or development?
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
So what happens to all the evolution? What happens to the mental particle?
Well, we wouldn't use the word particle, moments.
Okay, what happens to these moments accumulate, right? It develops.
Accumulate. They change. Just like at the physical world level, you can't create matter and energy. You can't destroy it. You can only transform it. So similarly, the mind is just transformation, with no beginning and no end. Like the physical world, no beginning, no end.
So it doesn't have direction of evolution. It doesn't become more evolved or more developed or more...
It depends on us. And we're going to talk about this a little bit tomorrow. We're going to go into this in detail tomorrow, I think. Some philosophies say that we are constantly improving. Buddhism says whether we improve or not is up to us. It's what we do with our mind. We can improve or we can go backwards, depending on what we do with our mind. Because our mind is created through causes and conditions. So depending on what we do there will depend on how the mind develops, whether it improves or goes backwards. But you can't create or destroy it. You can just transform it. How it transforms is under our control.
Do you explain again what do you mean by flow of change and nothing flows through time?
In the physical world,
the particles move and change, but like they should one particle and it moves.
Right, but when we look at, when we say particle, let's say atom, atom is made up of subatomic particles. And then if we look at a subatomic particle, that's made up of something. And we can keep going down and never hit the bottom. And these particles, I think in classical physics, often talk about fluxing in and out of existence. They're not solid. Even in classical physics, I think they say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I mean by flow of change. There's no solid thing that is moving. There's just this flux of change, constant, at the physical world. Similarly, the mind is just a flow of change. There's not a thing, a mind that is moving through time, a static thing. So in the physical world, there's no static things. There's just change. In the mental world, there's no static thing. There's just change.
You said that there's a phenomenon that like, come up from like atoms create molecules, which is so, like all the particles create the ball.
To answer this well, we have to talk about the Buddhist view of reality. But also, if you're interested in this, read a little bit about quantum physics. Yeah. So the Buddhist theory of reality has some similarities to the quantum physics.
Just about that, I think the word is perspective. Also, quantum physics say that everything is a wave and matter, and just how we look at it and our perspective on it.
Of course, what we need to realize, and I'm no scholar of quantum physics, but there are a number of different interpretations of quantum physics. So there's no uniform agreement about what this data implies at the quantum level. One of those interpretations is fairly close to Buddhist ideas. Other interpretations are not. So we need to be careful and not throw quantum physics in one little neat, because there are a number of different interpretations. As in Buddhism, there are a number of different interpretations of the nature of reality. So even in Buddhism, we talk about four philosophical schools that don't agree about what is the nature of reality. So also in quantum physics, there's not a uniform agreement. But certainly there is some sort of similarities there at that level between quantum physics and the view of reality that we're going to be talking about here in this course.
So if the consciousness and the consciousness is there at the beginning, but how does that relate to the idea that your specific consciousness is linked to you? Right? Like the idea of rebirth, but that you're reborn based on your past.
Topic for tomorrow. We're going to talk about it in detail. We're going to go through the whole process tomorrow in detail. Tomorrow. Okay, let's move on to this morning's topic now. And that is, we're going to go on to the second noble truth. The truth of the cause or origin of dukkha, or suffering. And what we saw there yesterday very briefly in the second noble truth was there were two things that identified as the cause or origin of our current state of dukkha. The first was the mental afflictions, in Sanskrit, klesha. So the cause or origin of dukkha or suffering are these two factors here, mental afflictions and actions. Mental afflictions in Sanskrit is klesha. And klesha is defined as anything that agitates or disturbs the mind. So that's why I prefer the English translation of mental affliction, A klesha is something that afflicts our mind, disturbs our mind. Sometimes this is translated as disturbing emotions, but that could be a bit misleading because not all kleshas are emotions. Sometimes it's also translated as delusions, afflictive emotions, many different translations. But personally, I prefer mental afflictions because I feel that's more close to the original etymology of the word klesha, something that afflicts and disturbs the mind. Now, and so that's the first. And of course, then our mental afflictions, things like anger, jealousy, craving, anxiety, depression, and so forth, these are what's driving our behavior, our actions. And the Sanskrit word for action is karma. And the Buddhist assertion is that every action we do based on a mental affliction has a result, has a consequence. So this Buddhist theory of karma is the law of cause and effect in terms of our actions and our experiences. And so, of course, all of our experiences collectively was described by the Buddha using the word dukkha. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at the mental afflictions this morning, and we're going to look at the actions of karma this afternoon. That's the topics for today. Mental afflictions, as we saw briefly yesterday afternoon, when we get an extensive presentation of this in Buddhist psychology, you have those 26 mental afflictions we saw briefly yesterday afternoon. In the 26, there are 6 root mental afflictions and 20 secondary mental afflictions. So there are 6 main mental afflictions, and the other 20 come out of that. But even those 6 root mental afflictions, we can condense into 3 main mental afflictions. Which we briefly touched on yesterday, often called the 3 poisons, because they poison our mind, they contaminate our mind. The first is ignorance, translation of the Sanskrit word avidya. Sometimes another word used here that has a similar meaning is confusion. Which is a translation of the Sanskrit word moha. And ignorance or confusion, the word here, of course, ignorance means, in general, simply being confused about something, not knowing something. But here, in the 3 poisons, we're talking about a very specific type of ignorance. We're talking about an ignorance that of the nature of reality. And we're not talking about simply not knowing the nature of reality, but here we're talking about actively misunderstanding the nature of reality. So ignorance here is misunderstanding the nature of reality. And within Buddhist philosophy, this misunderstanding can be in a number of different ways we can misunderstand the nature of reality. In a very simple way, how we misunderstand reality is a little bit what we just touched on just now. We relate to things as if they're stable and unchanging. But if we look closely, there is no stability here whatsoever. There is simply constant change. The idea, what's called impermanence. Impermanence means changing moment by moment. And of course, I think we all intellectually accept that because science has proven it. We learned it at school that everything's changing moment by moment. So I think none of us have any problem with intellectually accepting that idea. But is that how we relate to things instinctively? No. Instinctively, we relate to objects such as this bowl as if they're stable and unchanging. So the way in which we relate to things is out of sync with the way they actually exist. And the Buddhist assertion is that if we relate to things out of sync to how they actually exist, we create mental afflictions and suffering because of that, because of being out of sync with reality. And we can understand that at a very simple level. You know, if we have some thing that we own, some very nice thing, my thing, and suddenly it breaks, we get upset. Why do we get upset? Because we know intellectually change is happening. It's inevitable that it will finish. But we still get upset. And we get upset because instinctively we are holding on to that it's not going to change. And that's why we get upset. So that's at a very simple level. But here, we're going to focus on a deeper level of ignorance than that. And at the deepest level here, what we're going to focus on is our misunderstanding in terms of how we exist and the world around us exists. Now, we instinctively believe there is a me here and an independent, objective world out there. So we believe in an independent me and an independent, objective world. According to Buddhism, this is a false view of reality. There is no independent me here, no independent, objective world out there. So that is the fundamental ignorance that we're mainly talking about in this course. This grasping onto independent me, independent, objective world. And that leads to the other two mental afflictions. Which, of course, we've already briefly looked at, attachment and aversion. Because if we grasp on there's an independent me here, independent world there, then it really does seem like those pleasant things out there are the source of my happiness, so we instinctively have attachment to those. And those unpleasant things out there that seem to be the source of my suffering, we instinctively have aversion to those. So this belief there's me here, independent world there, will lead us naturally to have attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things. So these are the three core mental afflictions, and all other mental afflictions like craving and jealousy, anxiety and depression and fear, all come out of one of those or a combination of them. So these are really the core mental afflictions. This ignorance, I'd like to, of course, talk about that in detail in a couple of days' time when we talk about the nature of reality. So we'll talk about that in a lot more detail then, so we'll leave that now. What I'd like to talk about now is these two mental afflictions, attachment and aversion, to define what they are and to dispel some misunderstanding about them. So that's what we're going to do now. Question. That's going to come in a couple of days' time. Yeah. I mean, that's a huge topic, and I'm going to explain a lot of detail.
It means that we're two separate things. We think that we are two separate things?
Independent. Like, a short answer is we don't feel as if we are contributing to the existence of this in any way. Do we? That it exists from its own side. That we've got nothing to do with the existence of this object. That's how we naturally feel. That's this. The belief there's an independent me here and an independent objective world out there waiting for us to experience it, existing from its own side, and that we are in no way contributing to the existence of this world. This is what we're talking about here. Okay. We're coming to that right now. I'm coming to that. Let me define these two mental afflictions. Attachment, or in Sanskrit, raga, is defined as a mental factor. So remember all these mental factors we talked about yesterday. Attachment is a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. So attachment is a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. It then exaggerates the object's attractiveness. So it sees the object as attractive. It then exaggerates the object's attractiveness. And then wishes to possess and hold the object. So it wishes to possess and hold the object. Why? Because attachment believes that object is the source of our happiness. Aversion is this pushing away of unpleasant things. And that aversion can manifest in a number of different ways. From mild irritation to annoyance to anger, hatred, hostility. These are all types of aversion. So often here in the three poisons, instead of seeing aversion, you will see anger. Because anger is a very strong type of aversion that is very destructive. So we're going to focus on anger. So the definition of anger in Buddhism is it is a mental factor that sees its object as unattractive. So anger is a mental factor that sees its object as unattractive. It exaggerates the object's unattractiveness. So it sees the object as unattractive. It exaggerates its unattractiveness and then wishes to harm the object. So it sees the object as unattractive. It exaggerates the unattractiveness and then wishes to harm the object. Why? Because anger sees that object as a source of our suffering. So what we see in both of these definitions, and this applies to all mental afflictions, is this factor of exaggeration, of distortion. So all mental afflictions distort reality. And this is also quite well known in psychology. In fact, I've got a quote here from one of the books from Dalai Lama where he says, "Recently, a psychotherapist told me that when we generate anger, 90% of the ugliness of the object of our anger is due to our own exaggeration. This is very much in conformity with the Buddhist idea of how mental afflictions arise." So also in psychology, it's understood that things like anger exaggerate and distort. So certainly in Buddhism, that is a common thing amongst all mental afflictions. So what I'd like to do now is have a look at both attachment and anger and try to dispel some misunderstandings about them. First, I'd like to focus on anger. Now, generally, of course, we understand anger is very destructive and that's something we want to overcome. But even still, often there can be the thought, yes, it's destructive, but sometimes I have to use anger to be able to deal with a difficult situation. It's absolutely true that anger is very forceful, but from a Buddhist perspective, it's out of control. It's distorted reality. And what we can know from our own experience is that when we're caught up in very strong anger, often how we react to a difficult situation is not really resolving it. It often makes it much worse. So, according to Buddhism, we do not need anger to deal with difficult situations. And in Buddhism, then you'll hear often, instead of anger in difficult situations, practice patience. But then more confusion comes. Because often when people hear that they need to be patient when it's a difficult situation, they feel to be patient. Okay, according to Buddhism, I just got to sit there and do nothing. That is not patience. If we sit there and do nothing and allow someone to physically harm us, this is not helpful. This is not patience. Patience is not a behavior from a Buddhist perspective. Patience is a mental attitude. Patience in Buddhism, and we'll talk more about this in a couple of days, patience in Buddhism is defined as an undisturbed mind in the face of a difficult situation. So if we can maintain an undisturbed mind in the face of a difficult situation, meaning we can remain calm and clear, we can better see that situation more accurately. And we have a better chance of making a better response to that situation. If we allow our mind to get caught up in anger, we magnify, we distort, we react. We often overreact. So if we can remain calm, we can more clearly see what's really going on and then have a better way of responding. So with patience, we can respond rather than react with anger. And what is the forceful thing we can use in a difficult situation is compassion. Compassion can be very forceful. Often people feel people who are compassionate are weak and people who are angry are strong. Actually, it's exact opposite. People who get angry are weak because they have to resort to anger to deal with difficult situations, whereas compassion is strength. Remember, compassion is wanting or wishing or aspiring for that person to overcome their suffering and its causes. And the causes are the mental afflictions. So often if someone is behaving badly, it's because they're caught up in mental afflictions. They're caught up in anger, jealousy, craving, or whatever. So compassion is not just sort of sitting there and smiling and saying nice things to people. Compassion is trying to help that person to overcome their mental afflictions and suffering. So if someone is behaving badly, then we can have very strong compassion to really be very forceful in stopping that person from acting in a negative, harmful way and still be compassionate to the person and not attacking the person with anger. So we can really use compassion in a very forceful, strong way if someone is misbehaving. So this is how we can deal with difficult situations from a Buddhist perspective. We don't need to resort to anger. Any question about that? Right. I was hoping someone would bring up this question. Recently, I read a book written by a psychologist or psychotherapist, and they were very strongly refuting the idea that we should get rid of anger altogether. Because their assertion is, if we don't have anger, how do we deal with issues like social injustice? And when I was reading this book, it became very clear to me how they were using the word anger is very different to how we're defining it here. Here, anger always has the intention to harm. That's part of the definition of the word anger here. You know, for example, the classic is, you know, let's say a young child runs across the road without looking and nearly gets hit by a car, and the mother sees that. You know, the mother after that wouldn't just go, oh, Johnny, please watch out when you're walking across the road. Does she? She goes, Johnny, what are you doing? You know, but is she, and then people go, oh, she's really angry with him. But generally, I think she's not angry from this perspective. She has strong compassion and uses very forceful language to get through to the child that this is dangerous behavior. But often we'd say, oh, that's anger. But anger is not an action, it's a mental attitude. So, of course, if the mother's wishing to harm the child, which I doubt, then it would be anger. But if she's wanting to help the child and she uses very strong language, this is compassion. This is forceful compassion. So I think this is maybe what this person was using with the word anger, this forceful compassion to overcome social injustice. So again, Buddhism would not use the word anger in that context. Of course, if you want to harm people in the name of social injustice, now that's not going to be very helpful. Because then we're just like the perpetrators.
Can we use the word rage instead of anger?
Again, this aversion has many flavors, from mild irritation to annoyance to anger to rage, hatred. All of these are variations of this in different forms. And they all have a little bit different flavor, but they're all coming from this primary aversion, and then it grows in different ways. Yeah.
Just to take the mother a little step further, so she's got strong compassion, she uses strong words, and then she hits the child out of compassion.
Okay, what we're going to see more and more in this course is compassion alone is not enough, because we can end up doing very harmful things in the name of compassion. We need wisdom. So in everything we do, we need both compassion and wisdom. Because if we don't have wisdom, compassion can be blind and compassion can turn into really horrendous acts in the name of compassion. So we need to have them together as much as we can. So a very good question.
That example is in Paul Ekman's book with the Dalai Lama, Psychologist of Emotions.
Maybe.
About running across the road, his daughter used to do it as a game. His daughter would run out onto the road as a game. And
sorry?
His daughter run out onto the road as a game, and he would slap her out of anger, out of fear of his daughter. And the Dalai Lama agreed it was an example of compassionate anger.
But again, maybe then using the word anger in terms of how it's defined in psychology. But again, here, compassionate anger are two opposites. They can't go together. Because one wants to harm, the other one wants to help. Anger wants to harm, compassion wants to help.
Oh, yeah, it was a discussion there.
Yeah. So in that case, when we're using very strong behavior with compassion, we wouldn't say that's somehow anger. So again, remember here, anger, and this is part of the difficulty is, and that's what we're going to see also now after the break, we're going to talk about attachment. Also similar difficulty in terminology in between Buddhism and psychology with the word attachment. Same problem. So that's why it's very important here to clearly define how these words are defined and used in Buddhism. Otherwise, we get all sorts of strange ideas. And that's why I think in that book, that person was really very strongly refuting the Buddhist idea that we should get rid of anger altogether. But it came clear to me that he didn't appreciate how anger is defined in Buddhism. He was taking the psychology definition of anger and putting that in this context. And that's why I think confusion. Anyway, we need a break, so let's take a 10 or 15 minute break, and then we'll come back and talk about attachment.